Blog Talk Radio.
It's the V-Spot. I'm your host, Dr. Vic Tater. My co-host is Bill Foster. V-Spot Radio is brought to you by Planet Vic Tater Blog Network. Get everything you need and a few things you truly do not want. Only at Planet Vic Tater. All right, we're on the air. Special Sunday morning edition. I'm talking to J.M. DeMatte. I think I got that right.
DeMatteis.
DeMatteis, damn it.
That's it. You got it now.
DeMatteis, okay, that's it. All right. Sir, okay, thank you. Once again, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
I've been trying to get some comics guests for a long time, and you're like a very big one to have.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to do it.
Okay, I just want to start. How did you, so you read comics as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. I've said this before. I actually don't remember a time when I didn't read comics, you know, even like before I could read. I just feel like I can't, some people can say, oh, I remember the first comic I ever read. I can't. I just remember them being around. I have no clue how or why or who gave the first one to me or anything, but comics were just always a part of my consciousness probably since I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. They were just there, and I fell in love with them, and it's been a love affair that hasn't gone away.
Okay. How did you, when you were a kid, what was your favorite comic?
You know, I got to tell you, I really love, there was something just about, first and foremost, just something just about comics. There's something about that mix of words and pictures. And especially from a kid's point of view, you know, they're so colorful, they're so magical. Even the covers, I remember being a kid and I would just sit and stare at the covers before I'd even read the story, because something about the covers, they were like dimensional portals that would suck me through and take me to some other dimension, you know. But I guess as I grew up, probably originally growing up with the DC superheroes, I would guess that probably Justice League and Green Lantern were my real, real favorites. And then when I was in junior high school was when I discovered Marvel and went completely berserk for Marvel as well, and just loved really everything, but basically especially anything with Lee and Kirby together on it was a real favorite. Thor and Fantastic Four especially, and of course I loved the John Romita Spider-Man and so many other great comics that nourished me growing up.
So how did you get started in writing comics?
You know, I was always a creative person. Art was one of my obsessions when I was a kid and into my teenage years. I actually really thought I was going to grow up and be an artist, and was accepted, in fact, into the School of Visual Arts, which is a very good art school in Manhattan. And for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was that my family didn't have a hell of a lot of money, I ended up not doing that. And it was also in that same period of my life, I was also a musician, and my passion for rock and roll sort of overcame my passion for art. So I went off in that direction. But I was also writing all through that time, too. So I always continued writing, yeah, whether in journals or writing short stories or whatever it was, I was always writing. And I just knew that I wanted to do something creative with my life. And comics were such a passion. It wasn't the only thing I wanted to do, but certainly one of the things I wanted to do was to get involved with comics. And as I got older in my teen years, and people like Steve Gerber kicked open new doors in comics. So you could actually, you know, grow up with comics, and the comics were growing up with you. They were still challenging to me when I was 19 or 20 in the same way they were when I was, you know, 10 or 11. And so I said, yeah, I knew I wanted to do that. So I basically just started a process of knocking on doors, you know, and sending and writing samples and just trying to find a way in. And eventually what happened was I'd sent some samples to DC Comics, and this was in the late 70s, and I got a note back saying basically that Paul Levitz was looking for scripts for House of Mystery and House of Secrets and Weird War Tales and all those anthology books that DC used to do back in the day, none of which I'd ever heard of or ever even read, you know, because they were not on my radar. So I ran out and I bought a bunch of those and checked them out and sent Paul a bunch of samples, and that began a correspondence that probably went on for, you know, a few months before I finally made an appointment, went up to see him at DC, pitched him some stories. He bought one, And from that one sale of some weird little 8-page story in December of 1977 has come a career that hasn't stopped.
You mentioned that you were doing art before. Do you think the fact that you came from a kind of art background that helped you as a comic book writer working with artists?
You know, probably. You know, I'm a very visual person. I really do see things in my head, in images. I actually see them in movies. A lot of times stories come to me in the form of like little movies in my head. I will wake up in the morning and suddenly there'll be some movie playing and I'll go, oh, what's this? And I'll watch it for a while and I'll realize it's a new story, you know? And I don't know whether that comes from the art or was I drawn to the art because I was already seeing movies in my head and I was just visual. But certainly, you know, spending so many years involved in visual expression and drawing can only help in comics because I do tend to see things very, very easily in pictures. I can't imagine how you could possibly write comics if you don't have that kind of visual sense, if you're not seeing pictures in your head. So, go ahead.
Actually, in that respect, do you basically write to the artist almost in a screenplay-like method?
Well, there are two different... When you say write to the artist, what exactly do you mean?
It's when you write the script and you give them notes on how to do the panels and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely part of it. You know, there's two ways of two traditional ways of doing comic book scripts, and we all come up with hybrids in between. There's what's called Marvel style, which begins with a plot. You know, back in the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby days, the plot was, you know, hey, Jack, let's bring back Dr. Doom. And Kirby would go home and draw 22 pages and Stan would dialogue it and mess around with it and change whatever he wanted in the dialogue stage. But in my era, the plot is a very, very detailed blueprint for the story. And my plots usually were very, very tight, often breaking things down into panels, suggested dialogue, things like that. You know, you go off and you explain the emotional subtext of the story. Then the artist draws it. And then the beauty of that is you get the art back from your plot, and then you dialogue from the artwork, which opens up a whole new way of doing things because sometimes there might be a sequence that in your mind you envisioned as you were going to write a lot because you want to get across the emotions, you want to get across the psychology, and then suddenly the art comes in, you look at two or three pages and you realize the artist has put, there's so much emotion, there's so much of what you wanted to communicate is already there in the artwork that you have to say very little or sometimes you say nothing. You know, the classic example for me was years ago when I was writing Spectacular Spider-Man and working with a brilliant artist, Sal Buscema. We did a story where Harry Osborn died. And there was a two- or three-page sequence at the end that I, you know, wrote up in the plot and knew that I was going to be writing a lot because I wanted to tug those heartstrings and make sure that, you know, the people really, really felt Harry's death in a very, you know, deep way. And I get the art pages in from Sal, and I looked at them, and I went, it's all there. I don't have to say a word. And there, if you look at the book there at the end of the story, there's three silent pages that end the story because Sal nailed it so perfectly. The flip side of that is sometimes you envision a sequence a certain way and the art comes in and you go, oh, nothing that I wanted to communicate is on this page. And you have to really write, and sometimes, unfortunately, you have to overwrite to compensate for the lack in the artwork. So that's what happens Marvel style. Full script is really more like a screenplay in the sense that you're in total control. It's all there on the page. It's panel one, you know, page one, panel one, the camera angle, the details about the panel, then you put in the captions, you put in the dialogue, it's all there on the page. So you don't get that spark of seeing the artwork before you do the dialogue, but you do get to be really in control of your materials in a different way. But even there, you can give a full script to five different artists and it will come back five different ways. You know, it's so much, you know, no matter how you cut it, comics are a collaboration, and you need terrific writing, and you need terrific art, and you pull one of those elements out, and I don't care how brilliant the art is, if the story fails, the book fails. If the writing is brilliant and the art falls apart, the book fails, you know? But those are the two major ways that comics are done, and you always, you know, you have to be, as we go back to what we said before, you got to be thinking visual. Sometimes when I sit down to write a full script, even though I'm writing full script, what I do first is I'll write the whole story out just in the visuals, because I'm seeing it, so I want to get those visuals down, and then I go back and I start adding the captions and the dialogue and playing with it that way. it's a really, really wonderful and fun way to work, and the best part about it is the collaboration with the artist.
Okay, just go back to that for a minute about Spectacular 200 when Harry Osborn died.
Yeah.
My favorite panel from that story, the one that really sticks out to me, because I haven't read that comic in years, but I still remember it, is that at the end of the story, you see little Normie Osborn, and he's looking at Peter Spider-Man, and he just has this look of a twisted hate in his eyes.
Right. I don't know if that was in that issue. That might have been in a follow-up issue. Because after that, little Normie had this little Spider-Man rag doll that he used to drag around with him and beat the hell out of him. You know what I mean?
When was it decided that you were going to kill off Harry Osborn?
You know, a lot of these things aren't decided like, you know, people get together and go, oh, let's kill Harry. It wasn't really like that. You know, I came on to Spectacular Spider-Man, and I believe there had been a hint in a story before then about Harry maybe starting to lose it a little bit, you know? And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I love the relationship between Harry and Peter, especially when Harry was the Green Goblin, because what is cooler than two guys who are very best friends, totally love each other, and then are also simultaneously enemies, you know? That's why that last story was called Best of Enemies, you know? Because they're best friends, and they're absolute archenemies. And there's so much complex material in there psychologically and emotionally to play with that over the course of my 2-year run in Spectacular, that's why the Harry story kept looping back in. You know, we did a six-part thing called The Child Within. We did some other stories. Harry came back, did some other stories. Harry came back, and we finished it off with his death. So I didn't sit down at the beginning of that and say, I think Harry will die at the end. It was just what happens when the stories really work is the stories themselves lead you. The characters themselves lead you. So that I didn't make a decision to kill Harry. It just sort of happened in the writing. It was like, oh, this is the path this story is on. Because the story to me is like a horse. You know, you get on it and you think, oh, I'm going to start riding. Going to start riding east, and you start galloping off, and your horse rears up and rides 100 miles to the west, and you have a choice. You can either try to rein the horse in and go back the way you were going, in which case the horse is probably just going to throw you off, if not trample you. Or you just go for the ride, and when a story's really working, you go for the ride. And with Harry, it was that kind of thing. The characters took over, the story took over, and then one day it was like, oh, Harry's going to die. And I get surprised by these things, and I know if I'm surprised by an event as I'm writing it, then I hope the readers will be surprised too. Because that, for me, you know, if I've got it all mapped out to the point where I know everything that's going to happen for the next 2 years, that's boring. I always like to have a framework, a beginning, a middle, an end, a structure there. But I have to constantly remain open to surprises because the best stories constantly surprise me.
Actually, that's a bit of a problem with the recent comics, how they basically kind of plan too much in advance.
I don't know for a fact if that's it, but I do know that over the years what's happened is that where there used to be a lot more freedom for the writer to come on a book and tell his story, what happened in more recent years is that a lot of the stuff comes from the top down now. You'll get people up the food chain, editors, executive editors, publishers, whatever, who are saying, all right, here's what we're going to do now, and let's bring the writers in to execute our vision. It's just a different way of doing it. It's not good or bad. It's just a different way of doing it. For me as a writer, you know, I prefer to have the freedom, like when I was on Spectacular Spider-Man, since we're talking about that. You know, Danny Franger, author, was a wonderful editor, just said, you know, write your stories. And, you know, he was the custodian of Spider-Man. If I went too far and, you know, too far off the beaten path, he's there to remind me. But he really gave me the freedom to write the stories that I wanted to write in the way that I wanted to write them. And it was a lot more common than when you have top-down stories or when you have constant big events coming up, you know. Well, now all these stories have to be geared to the filter of this big event that's crossing over through everything. It does curtail your ability to tell stories that are more deeply personal and that you're more passionate about. And at the same time, there are still plenty of guys out there that are able to do it. But it's also why I think you see more and more people doing their own creator-owned projects, because when you go off into that world, nobody says boo. You're left alone to do the story exactly your way and exactly the way that you want to do it, and nothing beats that.
I was going to ask you something about Kraven's Last Hunt, because I've read over the years that you originally intended it to be a story with Wonder Man and Grim Reaper.
You know, that was one of those stories where the story had control. I thought I had control, and the story didn't. You know, and it did. It started as a pitch for a Wonder Man miniseries because I vaguely remember there was an Avengers story where Wonder Man was killed and then he regenerated, and I thought, well, wouldn't that be cool if you know the same thing happened again, but when Wonder Man regenerated, you know, he, years of his life had been lost. You know, he comes back and I loved the relationship with his brother was sort of like the Harry Peter relationship. So I started playing with that. I pitched this miniseries to Tom DeFalco, who, thank God, turned it down, you know, for whatever reason. And then I reworked it as a Batman story. And it was a very similar premise, except it was Batman and the Joker killed Batman. And then that got rejected, and I reworked it again with Batman and Hugo Strange, and that got rejected. And this is what happens, and I watch this with stories. You know, you think you're in control, and then you put it out there, and something happens, and the story doesn't get made, and you pitch it again, and it doesn't get made. But what to me, what's really going on is that story is seeking the right form for expression, you know? So with that story was meant to be a Spider-Man story from day one, you know? So I would go out and try to pitch it and see what happened. It didn't work. And then finally I got offered, Mike Zeck and I got offered the Spider-Man gig, and I thought, what about that story? I really like that idea of the hero buried alive. And so I kind of took elements from the Batman graphic novel that I had pitched and reworked it. And originally Craven wasn't even in it. I just sort of created a Marvel Universe version of Hugo Strange. And they loved the story. They approved it, and we were getting ready to start it. And I was sitting in my office and flipping through one of the Marvel Universe handbooks, you know, just for fun, and came across the entry on Kraven the Hunter and started reading about it. And there was something in there that said that Kraven was Russian. Now, I'm a huge fan of Dostoevsky, Russian literature. And that really just set something off in my head, and I said, this is the guy I want to use. And it was completely, to me, it was a completely random moment. But if you look at it from a more cosmic perspective, it was the story itself, you know, finding all the elements that it needed. And so I pulled in Kraven, and then Zeck, you know, since I had Zeck on the book, we had created the Vermin character together when we did Captain America a few years before that. And so all those elements came together perfectly to create the story in a way it could have never been had it been a Wonder Man story or a Batman story. It wouldn't have been that story. It wouldn't have been as good. So I was, in retrospect, very grateful for all the rejection along the way because it allowed the story itself to kind of cook and get to the place it needed to become Kraven's Last Hunt. And now I can't imagine it as anything but a Spider-Man story. I can't imagine the engine driving it that would drive it as much as Peter's love for Mary Jane pulling him up out of that grave, you know?
One of the things I was curious about was that being originally Wonder Man Grim Reaper, and I don't know if you'd remember this, did you know how you were going to give Grim Reaper the ability to mimic his superpowers?
Oh, you know, that element probably wasn't even in the story then. You know, that element came in when I was playing with the Batman idea, and the idea was that Hugo Strange was going to kill Batman and then take over the identity.
Okay. When you were going to kill off Kraven, did you have to get permission from the Spider-Man editors? Did they give you any grief about it?
You know, people always ask it because if you look at that story in context of when it came out, it was the darkest, grimmest, most intense Spider-Man story I think that had ever been done up to that point in time. You know, by today's standards, you know, maybe not so much, but certainly for 1987 or 8, whenever it was. And yet nobody objected to anything. I pitched the story. The original editor on the book was Jim Owsley, and then Jim Salicrup took over. I pitched the story. Everyone said, fine. And I wrote it just the way it was in my head. No one changed anything. No one changed a comma or a period in the script. And what you saw on the page was exactly the story as I envisioned it. As I recall, the only change that was made to that story was a minor art change in one panel where Zeck drew Vermin, and to show that he was a cannibal, there were a lot of bones around. And Jim Shooter said, can we have a few less bones in the panel? That was the only change that was asked for in 6 issues of that story. So we were really left alone to write and draw that story exactly the way we wanted to do it.
Were you expecting Kraven to stay dead, or were you writing it with the ideal that he might get brought back, like just in a typical, you know, villain death?
You know, to me, it wasn't a typical villain death. I mean, you know, the typical villain death is, oh, look, he's on the helicopter and it blows up, you know, and oh, there's always some way that he jumped out of the copter. But this was Craven putting a rifle in his mouth, you know what I mean, and blowing his head off. So in my mind, dead was dead, you know. And the truth is, he stayed dead for what, 25 years?
Yeah, a long time.
A long time.
Very long.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and I have to say that the story that Joe Kelly did, Grimhunt, that brought him back was actually excellent, and it was brought back in a way that I thought really, really worked. And, you know, 25 years, that's a couple of generations of comic book readers. I mean, that's pretty good. You know, Harry Osborn stayed dead for quite a long time, too, before they brought him back. Aunt May, on the other hand, was only dead for about 15 minutes before they brought her back.
Yeah, you know, bringing Aunt May back, that was one of those things. I remember at the time I had a problem with that, and the reason was, you know, when you have a supervillain die in a book, to me, that's like, you know, well, they're super already, you know. But when Aunt May dies, she's just a regular old lady.
Right, right. No,
you know, and then you mix her up in that crazy world, you know. To me, it kind of takes apart, it kind of fractures the world of Peter Parker too much.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and my biggest problem with it, and, you know, again, it's comics, so the truth is, you know, everybody comes back eventually. Look, it took Bucky, what, you know, 60 years to come back, but he came back, you know.
Yeah, found a way.
You know, so you know, you got to think, at some point, someone somewhere is going to bring the character back. With Aunt May, they brought her back, it was within like a year, I think. It was pretty quick.
I think it was 2 years.
So 2 years, you know, that's really, really, really pretty quick. I didn't read the actual story, but from what I understand, there was some very convoluted thing about an actress who was pretending to be Aunt May, and it was like, you know, I think it would have been better if they just would have, you know, said, okay, we're rebooting this, and Aunt May never died, and here we go, you know. But the flip side is Aunt May is a great character, so a wonderful character to write, and she's an integral part of Peter's mythos, And that you can always go back to that story that I wrote and read that story, and it still exists. And I still, to this day, get people, you know, writing to me or talking to me about that Aunt May story and how much it moved them and touched them. And I really, really appreciate that. That was like one of the highlights of my career was I got a phone call from John Romita Sr. after that book came out to tell me that it's one of the few times in his life that reading a comic book actually made him cry. And if you get a call from John Romita Sr. telling you something like that, you know you must have done something right.
Yeah, I remember when I bought the comic and I was reading it, and like I was, let's see, it was 1994, so I'd have been like 13, and I remember my grandmother had died 2 years before that. And when I was reading it, I remember it actually made me cry. I mean, it would still make me cry if I read it. And I remember the part when Ben Reilly, the Scarlet Spider, when he was on top of the house show, and he's just kind of crying because of the fact that someone he loved so much was dead, and he couldn't even tell anybody.
Yeah, that was sort of the most tragic part of the whole thing, wasn't it? Poor Ben sitting up there, you know, he couldn't be in the room. He had no one to share it with. He's just sitting up there weeping his heart out. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm very proud of that story. And Mark Bagley, another wonderful, wonderful artist, did just a fantastic job with that. And there was another sequence there, as I recall, where I got the pages, and it's right after May actually passes away, and then we cut to the funeral, and I was prepared to write a whole bunch of stuff. And then the pages came in, and I said, this is just beautiful. All the emotion is in here. Let's do this as a silent sequence. And we did, if you look at the book, that it's all silent, and Bagley's art just nails it. Just great. And again, you know, the beauty of comics is that moment when you can just look at the art and go, everything I put in my plot, I put in my story, he just captured on the page. I don't have to add another word. That's great.
Yeah. I know that, you know, I mean, it's not the same thing, but, you know, we've done some of our projects, you know, and I've got it in art back from, and it feels so good to see something that you've actually created, actually see it in, like, it feels like it's alive at that point.
Yeah. To this day, that's my biggest kick. Working in comics is when, you know, and now it all comes in digitally and email, you know. Used to be you'd get a package and you'd pull the artwork out. You know, now I get an email and I crack it open and there's some art. And I'm working right now on a series that comes out in November from IDW called The Adventures of Augusta Wind. It's an all-ages fantasy. And I'm working with this wonderful artist from Greece named Vasilis Gogzilis. And his art is just so imaginative and so much fun. And every time I get a new page, I'm like, oh, my God, this is fantastic, you know. And the moment I open the art on any of these stories, you know, I have a Spider-Man story coming out in December, an amazing 700. And there's a wonderful Italian artist whose name I'm not going to be able to pronounce. They just call him Camo. I know that. He's really, really wonderful. And his art, same thing. But it reduces me to being like 10 years old. It's like I'm 10 years old and I'm laying on the floor reading a comic book. And that's the feeling I get when the art comes in and I crack open an email and find new pages there. It's just very, very magical. Very magical. So that's really one of the great joys of working in this business.
Okay, going to the Captain America run, which I still haven't got yet. Time to talk about it. Just got started. The big thing I noticed was that you're the one that brought back the Baron Zemo, Helmet Zemo, and
right.
Originally he had only appeared one time in, like, it was 100 issues before as the Phoenix, and he was killed off right there. What made you decide to bring him back?
You know, I remember it was a Roy Thomas story originally, where you had some villain, right? Was he called the Phoenix? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
And at the end of the story, you found out it was Zemo's son, and it stuck with me. It stuck in my head, and I thought this has the potential. You know, I'm always fascinated by father and son dynamics. You know, probably because we're all always trying to work out our own relationship with our fathers somehow. And writing stories is a great way to do it. And so I just thought he had the potential to be a really, really interesting, psychologically layered villain. And so I brought him back and got rid of the Phoenix thing and just made him Zemo, which is who he was, sort of taking up the father's mantle. And to have a villain that has, aside from the Red Skull, that has that connection to Cap's past, you know, from what at that point was, I guess, 40 years before. You know, it had a lot of resonance in a lot of different directions, and he worked out, and he's still out there, I believe, in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, he became a very big part of the Marvel Universe, like, just because a few years after that, he had that big Roger Stern story in Avengers where he was leading that Masters of Evil army.
Right, right.
And so, then, you know, later on, he became leader of the Thunderbolts.
Right. That's right. That's right. So it's, you know, it's always nice when you cook up something like that and people then pick up on it and continue it and evolve it. But he was a very interesting villain, and I like the villains where there are psychological layers, that they're not just like a lunatic, or they're not just, you know, twisting their mustache saying yeah ha ha. You really want something you can sink your teeth into as a writer, and he had that going for him.
There was this one line he had that I really liked at the end, near the end of the story, when he's got Captain America and he's just telling him, he said, I'm not interested in bringing back Third Rider, taking over the world. I just wanted, you know, he just wanted to kill Captain America.
Right, right, because that was such a typical thing of these, you know, these plots against Captain America. There's always some crazy Nazi wanting to bring back the Third Reich. There's always some lunatic wanting to take over the world. But for him, it was just profoundly personal. You know, and I tend to gravitate to the stories that are very, very personal, as opposed to the big take over the world plot, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, and it's funny how these things work out, you know, because with the Marvel Universe over the years, so many different people are writing it, but it's amazing how many threads come together, and it's almost like it was planned all along, even if that couldn't possibly be true.
Well, you know, it's sort of what I was saying before about how, you know, individual stories sort of take on a life of their own. I'm sure the same is true of the grander story of the Marvel Universe. And I think Grant Morrison has talked about this, too, with this idea that the DC Universe is alive, you know. But in the sense of that, you know, we're all contributing to this larger story that has a life of its own. And I never really thought about it until you just mentioned it. It's very interesting. You know, we're all sort of elements contributing to this mega story, you know, and this story is moving like some, you know, giant whale through the ocean, and we're all sort of putting our little pieces on it, but it's very much got its own destination and its own mind and its own life, and it's true. And somehow things, you know, some things don't, but a lot of things really do work out and find their way as if they had been planned from the beginning. Some silly throwaway idea that Stanley and Jack Kirby had, you know, in 1965 evolves into some huge thing, you know, 30, 40, 50 years later. So it's fascinating, really. And like I said, I never thought about it quite that way before, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, well, the next story you did, this is one of the things I wanted to mention, was you created a supporting cast for Steve Rogers, and I've noticed over the years, because I've been going through a lot of these Captain America issues, because I read a lot of Mark Gruenwald's run that took place after yours, and the runs before that people have tried to give Steve Rogers a life, and it never seems to quite work out, but you really gave them a supporting cast and really made it work.
Well, you know,
I
have to give a good part of that credit goes to Roger Stern, because a lot of that was in place from the Stern and Byrne run. The girlfriend Bernie was in there, and there were probably some other people. He had some other cast members. What I enjoyed was, you know, the idea that this guy was Captain America. You know, he represented all of America. So there was the Falcon, who was an African American, who was his best friend. His girlfriend was Jewish. You know, then I brought in a character named Arnie Roth, who was Cap's best friend growing up, who turned out to be gay, and I think was probably one of the first gay characters in mainstream comics, you know? So you had a black guy, you had a Jewish girl, you had a gay guy, you know, and then you had Bucky, this sort of kid, this man out of time, who became Nomad. So that's the element that I loved. And in fact, in the Red Skull story, that sort of climaxed my run, it used to drive the Red Skull crazy, you know? It's like, you know, that's everything that the Nazis hated. My God, a Jew, a gay man, a black man, you know? And, of course, for Captain America, that's like, this is America. This is what it's all about, you know? So it was a great way to have Cap personally connected to people, and it was also a great way to play with the bigger themes of the book. It's impossible to write Captain America and not find yourself swept up in bigger themes about America, because you have to. When you have a lead character who's basically wearing a flag, you know, and who represents the ideals of America. That's what I always felt. He doesn't represent the reality of the United States or any particular political point of view of the United States. To me, he always represented the highest ideals of the United States. And he was above politics and above all that other petty stuff that we're all hearing on TV 24 hours a day, you know. Great character.
When you mentioned Arnie, it's funny because I was starting at the Zemo story arc,
mm-hmm.
and I hear Arnie, and you know, and you had—I mean, you did a great job with, because it took me a while to figure it out. But he kept mentioning his roommate Michael, and he kept saying his roommate, and I was like, "This is," you know, it took me a minute to figure out he was gay, because he said he's. I was like, "Man, he really cares about his roommate."
Right.
It took me a minute. I was like, "Oh, wait, yeah, I'm stupid."
Right. Well, you know, we weren't hitting anyone over the head with it, and probably whatever year that was, 1983, you probably couldn't hit anyone over.
Yeah,
82. 82. Okay.
Yeah, it was done very well.
Yeah, and you know, later on in the Red Skull arc, it became clearer. I remember there was one issue where the Skull had basically captured all these guys, captured Bernie and Arnie and the Falcon, and he put on this little cabaret show where he had Arnie made up sort of like Joel Grey in Cabaret, and come out and give a speech about what an inferior, you know, inferior, horrible human being he was. And it was very clear in the speech that he was gay at that point. It was very, very clear. And Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, was uncomfortable with that and changed the dialogue on one of the pages. But then you turn the page and you get to the next page, and the speech didn't get changed. So it was, by that point, it was, I think, you know, it wasn't subtle anymore. It was very clear that's what he was, you know. But in the beginning, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't, you know, it was something that evolved, and it was in, I knew from the start that he was, but it wasn't anything that, you know, it wasn't like, hi, I'm the gay character. No, hi, I'm
right, it was done like a real person.
Yes, I'm Cap's best friend, you know, and I thought it was interesting.
It also wasn't written like, you know, we need to get some bullet points, like, okay, we need to have a gay person in there, we need to have this in here.
Right, right, and that, you know, now it would be like, you know, there'd be a press release, you know, a gay character in Captain America, you know, but then it was just another story. And someone pointed out to me, which I didn't even realize watching the movie, but in the Captain America movie, the character of Bucky, the way they played him in the movie, was really, a lot of it came from Arnie Roth, because that was what Arnie Roth was in the comic. He was Captain's best friend who kind of watched over his skinny little pal, you know? So they merged Arnie with Bucky, because, you know, you can't do a kid sidekick anymore, you know? So they took, I think, elements of the Arnie-Steve relationship, and they grafted it onto Bucky, and I thought it worked beautifully. I loved that movie. Loved that movie.
I did, too. I mean, you know, I was going in prepared to hate it.
Same here. Same here.
Yes, I
thought, this is going to be the stupidest thing I've ever seen. How are you going to make this work? And it's a World War II story, and you got this guy in the silly costume. And I wasn't even going to go. My wife is the person who said, come on, let's go see it. It looks like it's going to be fun. And I sat there. I was so entertained by that movie. I don't know if it's the best of the Marvel movies, but it's certainly the most just purely entertaining of the Marvel movies. You know, from beginning to end, it was really terrific. I really, really enjoyed it.
Okay. One of the other things you did in your run is that I was reading this last night. Was you did the Deathlok story? What made you decide to use Deathlok?
That was, you know, we worked on Captain America with a wonderful, wonderful guy who sadly is no longer with us, Mark Gruenwald. You know, one of the best editors,
right.
One of the best editors Marvel ever had. Smart and so immersed in the Marvel universe, in every little nook, cranny and corner of the Marvel universe. His knowledge of Marvel history was just, you know, I mean, he was the guy behind the handbooks, you know, because he was a walking encyclopedia. And he was the guy who came to me and said, you know, we're coming up on the date from the original Deathlok stories when all this stuff is supposed to happen that's going to change the world. So why don't we do a story and see if we can, you know, we can meet that date and play with that and reverse it. And I wasn't all that – I had read, you know, some Deathlok stuff when it first came out, interesting character, but I wasn't that familiar with all the continuity. And it was a lot of very twisted continuity, you know. And Gruenwald, and this says a lot about who he is, he sat down, he wrote up a whole timeline for me of every event that happened, you know, and where it was and what we could do. And I took all this information, I went off and I said, okay, so Mark Gruenwald's now just giving me all this incredible information, which I could have never figured out for myself, but I have to turn this into a story. And it really took me a while because, you know, elements, mythology, continuity, that's not a story. You need something to hook the characters into. And
yeah.
At one point I remember calling Mark up and saying, you know, I don't know if I can do this. I can't get this to make sense. He said, well, if you don't want to do it, don't worry about it. And I went off and I thought about it. And I came up finally with, as I recall, the hook for me, because Deathlok at that point, on top of everything else, there was Deathlok and there was a Deathlok clone. So there were two of them, you know. And it became, for me, one of my favorite themes, which is a search for personal identity. So you had the Deathlok clone seeking out Deathlok so that the two of them could find each other and truly understand who and what they were. And that hook of the search for personal identity is what got me into the story. Because if I can't find an emotional hook and a thematic hook, there's no story for me. And then the story just took off from there, and it was really, really fun. And it ended up being, I think, one of the very best stories that Mike Zeck and I did together. We really, really hit our stride on that story. And I think I said this to you on Twitter yesterday that, you know, the drag was right after that, Mike left the book to go do Secret Wars. And so here we were.
Yeah.
We really kind of – we reached this peak, and then he left. But he had to leave because, you know, when the editor-in-chief asked you to come write the big 12-part maxi series that he – to come draw the 12-part maxi series that he's writing, you don't say no. But I loved working with Zeck. Zeck was a phenomenal guy to work with.
Yeah, it was funny. I made a joke on Twitter when I was reading it, and it showed 1993, and everything's a barren apocalypse. And I said, Joe, you guys are only off by 10 years.
Right.
It's like, or maybe it'll be America a month from now.
Right. Well, let's hope not. Let's hope not. I'm a little more positive and hopeful than that. That was a really fun story, and there was a story that I was really drag kicking and screaming into, and there is the value of a really good editor, and Gruenwald was just a great guy and a great guy to work with. He was only like, I think, 42 when he died, and it's just, you know, it's one of those things that I think about even now, and it is just so unbelievably sad, unbelievably sad.
Yeah, he is one of my favorite writers. Like Squadron Supreme is one of my favorite comics ever, and also a lot of his Cap run that he did because he followed you.
Yes,
he wrote
that book longer than anybody, I think.
Right, and he wrote some great stories during that time.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the interesting things I noticed about this, you mentioned Secret Wars, is, and it talked about how all the superheroes disappeared. And the interesting thing is that you could take that as what was about to happen in Secret Wars, where the heroes disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was interesting how you could play that two ways.
What do you mean?
Okay, like in Secret Wars coming up, like, because it was on the verge of happening.
Yeah.
And heroes were brought to the battle planet, and I was thinking, you know, you could have said that they all died there or something.
Oh, I see. It would have been a place to sort of reboot the universe in a way, you know?
Right, or something like that. You know, it could have, because at first I didn't know that was going to be what caused all. I thought that it was alluding to Secret Wars at first, reading it, and it was also one of the things that, like, Mark Gruenwald brought the Nth Command back. How do you say that? The NTH, is it Ninth Command?
That's a good question. That's one of those things that you read it in a comic book, and you know, and I would think it would be Nth, but maybe, you know, I don't know. And unfortunately, maybe Ralph Macchio could answer that question, because he might have been part of that. But I don't.
Yeah,
I would just say Nth, because it's N T H. So what else could it be? You know.
Okay, and another thing you did was you brought back Jack Monroe, who was the 1950s Bucky, and I don't think he had actually shown up again since that story in the 70s.
Right, that was another one. There was an old little piece of continuity, which I thought, well, here's something interesting we can do, because I, you know, here are these characters, you know, from the 50s, who were brought back and so completely out of time. And this one, he's just a kid, you know. And then there was always the routine with, you know, Captain America, and like, oh, is Bucky really alive? Oh no, he's not. It's an android, or whatever the stupid story would be, you know. And so I remember that, you know, there's a lot about that because it's so long ago that I don't remember, but I remember writing that scene where Jack Monroe I don't think he had a name. I think I gave him the name Jack Monroe.
Okay, yeah.
And he shows up and at Steve's door, and Steve's first reaction is to beat the crap out of him, because it's like, you know, how many people over the years have tried to fool me with this fake Bucky routine, you know what I mean? So he just grabs him, flips him over, and slams him on the floor, you know, which was a very real, very human reaction, until he goes, no, I'm not that Bucky, I'm the other one, you know, so please stop beating me up, you know? And
yeah.
He was really an excellent character, again, because there was something to sink your teeth into. He's this kid from the 50s who's suddenly adrift in what was then the 80s with nothing to do, nowhere to go. So who does he turn to? You know, he turns to the one guy that he has a connection to, Captain America, and it was a really interesting relationship that they had.
Yeah, you know, it's funny the way he said it was, you know, it's like, no, I'm not the original Bucky, I'm the 1950s Bucky. You mean the one that teamed up the 1950s Captain America to try to kill me? Yeah.
Oh, right, that.
It's like, yeah. I don't think that's exactly going to make Cap calm down, but...
Right, but he's a compassionate guy, you know. I don't really remember the details, whether I think, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. had, like, because they had been given some drugs or something that made him crazy or something, and I think he'd been in rehab or something. You know?
Right, they'd been rehabilitating him, but they said that it was basically they'd had super soldier serum, but without the Vita rays.
Right, that sounds familiar. And I thought that original Steve Englehart, I think it was Steve Englehart who did the original story with the Cap of the 50s, was just a great, great story. Great story. His run on Captain America is one of the all-time best, I think. And it was just great to bring, you know, again, to just pluck a character who really, in that story, didn't really have a lot of character. He was just there, and bring him back and say, well, who is this guy, and how would he feel in this situation? A man out of time with no one to turn to, and then to also to reach back to that earlier Englehart run, and then pull the, you know, what is he going to be, Bucky? I'm going to run around and call myself Bucky? So he becomes Nomad. So he becomes, as he finds his self, as he finds his own identity, he becomes Nomad. And I don't know whatever happened to him. I don't know if he still exists in Marvel continuity, or if he's dead, or I have no clue whatever happened to that character. But I know that he was around for a while, and I think in the 90s even had his own book for a while.
Yeah. They ended up killing him a couple of years ago during the Winter Soldier story. Yeah, the Winter Soldier ended up killing him. They said that the Super Soldier Serum had basically started rotting his mind, and he was kind of going crazy.
I see.
Well, I hate to break it, but we're almost at our 45-minute mark, so Shabari.
All right. Okay.
Well, that flew by,
much.
Didn't it?
Yeah.
It sure did. Thank you very much. If you'd be interested, if you could come back some other time.
Well, maybe in the spring or something we'll do it again. How does that sound?
Okay, that'd be fine. Thank you very much for joining us. This was a great. I had a great time. Thank you very much.
Great to talk to you guys.
All right. Join us. We'll be back.